It's February 6, 2008, and I'm Kevin Grau, and I'm speaking today with Daniel F. Evans, Jr. for the IU School of Medicine History Project. Mr. Evans, before we go on to questions about Methodist and Clarion, could you tell us a bit about your background and biography?
I am the Chief Executive Officer of Clarion Health Partners, Inc., and have been since 2002. Prior to that time, I was a partner in a major regional law firm, Baker & Daniels, in downtown Indianapolis, and throughout the course of my career, I've held several government appointments, chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank under the first Bush administration, Administrative Conference of the United States, and several things like that. So I was a practicing lawyer before I assumed this job, and chairman of the board of Methodist Hospital at the time of the merger with Indiana University and Riley Hospitals.
To frame our conversation, looking back, thinking about where you were personally and professionally 30 years ago, would you have envisioned yourself as CEO of a large healthcare group like Clarion?
Now, 30 years ago, I was a practicing lawyer, much younger than I am now, in a law firm, working 12 hours a day, representing clients in civil and a few criminal legal matters. So no, would not have imagined that my career would take me into an administrative position in an academic medical center.
When early in your career, you worked on the 1976 re-election campaign of Dr. Otis Bowen. And Doc Bowen has been an important figure in Indiana politics and Indiana medicine. How did you first meet Doc Bowen?
I met Governor Bowen in 1975, in his first term as governor. I was introduced to him by an individual named J.B. King, who was a lawyer at Baker Daniels, who was his campaign chairman. So J.B. introduced me to Governor Bowen in the hopes that Doc would agree with J.B. that I should be hired as the campaign manager in 1976.
And in that campaign, in Governor Bowen's time in office, how did his profession as a physician and his role as a physician relate to his sort of his political career and his political activities?
Oh, Governor Bowen had two major accomplishments that are historic in nature. The first was significant property tax reform at the beginning of his first term, and tort reform. In other words, a limit on medical malpractice financial liability. Those two things both still exist. The medical malpractice limits have been raised a little bit. The property tax reform has lasted well over 35 years, and just now it's being reassessed, no pun intended, to look at. So his lasting contributions are in those two regards. Secondly, as a medical doctor in German Township, Marshall County, Indiana, he was literally the paradigm of the small town doc. So in Doc Bowen's way of operating, it was about relationships. And therefore, he moved legislation based upon relationships. Prior to being governor, he was Speaker of the House. And I think his career as a doctor, which was one-on-one all day long, set his mental attitude about how to sell a program, which was one-on-one.
Later, after his time as governor, he served as the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Were you working with him at the time?
Yes, in fact, again, J.B. King and I were asked by Doc Bowen to volunteer to assist him in the transition from being at that time a private citizen to Secretary of HHS. So we both went to Washington for some period of time, and on a pro bono basis, interviewed staff for him, made recommendations with respect to organization of the immediate office of the secretary, which, by the way, has a larger budget than the biennial budget of the state of Indiana. That's how big HHS is. His predecessor, Margaret Heckler, had a chef and a hairdresser in the secretary's office. He got rid of those rather promptly. Doc Bowen was a Hoosier, not a not someone who tried to draw attention to himself. So J.B. King and I spent probably 6 months assisting Governor Bowen in setting up his operation at HHS under the second Reagan term.
And for you personally, what were the most important skills and most important experiences that came out of that time for you?
Well, for me, it was seeing the complexity of the healthcare reimbursement schemes. Medicare and Medicaid had been around for about 20 years by that time after the Great New Society under President Johnson. So they were just beginning to get very mature. And so the Healthcare Finance Administration, the predecessor bureaucracy to the current CMS, was in place at the time, and I was able to meet with and deal with, on behalf of the secretary, the people that ran those things. Had I not had that experience, I would never have met with those folks one-on-one, much less been the person who interviewed them to make a recommendation to the then secretary, Doc Bowen. So it took me to the highest levels of U.S. healthcare policy and administration as a relatively young lawyer. And many of those people are still around today that ran the Healthcare Finance Administration, that ran the Social Security Administration, that hands out all the disability payments in this country. But I saw for the first time the millions of individual transactions involved in every place in America as people sought health care.
And when did you return to Indiana from Washington?
Well, I didn't actually go live in Washington. I just went back and forth, but the assignment ended, I don't know, probably in 87 sometime. Reagan didn't run for re-election in 88, and Doc left in 89.
You've had a long-standing relationship with Methodist Hospital. When did you first become involved with Methodist?
Well, I was born here, so that would be my first involvement, being a newborn in the building in which you and I are sitting right now, as a matter of fact. And my father had been the chairman of the board of Methodist Hospital, and I'd been a Boy Scout in the basement of this building. There was a troop in this building. So I guess you could say, all joking aside about being born here, my first relationship would be a Boy Scout in the basement of the building. And then I assisted as a young lawyer in helping the Methodist Health Foundation raise money for what we now call the new building, although it's 26 years old. Mm-hmm. That is the building on Senate Boulevard on the west side of the campus in which you and I are now sitting. So my involvement's been probably most of my adult career.
The Methodist is celebrating its 100th anniversary officially this year.
Yeah, April this year.
With all the changes in healthcare over the last few decades, does it surprise you that Methodist has made it through all these transitions?
No, ironically, it's the faith-based institutions and the educational institutions in our country that have gone through the most dynamic change and still exist. Mm-hmm. If Methodist had been a private business in 1908, then it would be a surprise that we're still around in 2008. That would be the exception. However, as a faith-based institution in 1908, its basic underpinnings are the same today as they were then. Just like IU, the basic underpinnings are exactly the same. Question really is does it do its work in a different way in 2008 because of contemporary requirements that it did in 1908? And the answer to that is obviously yes. So as long as the church and the university are able to keep their values clear, both have been extremely adaptable in the tactics they use to meet those values.
I'd like to talk a bit more in a second about those changing tactics. But I was reading a press item when you took the position here as CEO, and one of the things that was mentioned is that you still have an 1899 Epworth lead lapel button. And obviously that raises the question of how do you personally view your role here as CEO, and in terms of professionally and ethically as a calling, your relationship with Methodist and then in turn with Clarion.
If I were a pastor here at the hospital, I'd say it's a calling, not a job. Mm-hmm. But I'm not. It is a job, but it has the essence of a calling, and that is that the core work itself matters. Mm-hmm. And I'm very much aware that even though I don't lay hands on patients, I'm the steward of the system that makes it possible for those who do, like your wife, to have the maximum resources available to them. And my duty to the patients is to ensure that those who deliver the health care here work in an environment of mutual trust and respect, and therefore the patient comes first.
You have a long relationship with the hospital. And from that personal relationship, what's your sense of the historic importance of Methodist Hospital as an institution?
Well, Methodist Hospital's history is rich. The building in which you and I are now sitting is where the Lilly insulin trials were done in the early 1920s. One of the great medical breakthroughs of the 20th century were done here. To pick a more recent example, the first heart transplant in Indiana was done here in the mid-1980s, and the woman just died last year. She lived another 25 years after the surgery. There are hundreds of basic research projects ongoing and dozens of clinical trials, and have been since day one. So Methodist Hospital has been a place of innovation as well as healing. Number two, we're sitting in the building that was opened in 1908. Methodist Hospital has been here to serve the community, not to become a chain of department stores with branches all over the place and close the downtown store. The most complex care in the country is delivered in downtown Indianapolis. And that's the same as it was in 1908. Ironically, this has always been a trauma hospital, and if you pick any date and time and read an article about Methodist Hospital, and I've done several, they're always about some trauma. Some kid getting run over on his bicycle, person in an automobile accident, they end up here. So to give you a specific example, we have a great picture of a Methodist Hospital ambulance at the 1909 Indianapolis 500. Which would have been the year after Methodist Hospital was founded, and 2 years before the first official 500 race. So talk about historic continuity. It's remained the same from day one to day now. Number three, if I didn't want number three. I think buildings and architecture matter. And on top of this building is a lighthouse, a beacon, and that's been there an awful long time. And the purpose of it is to identify clearly what this building is about. And it's about being a sanctuary of healing. And that historical context goes straight back to John Wesley's three rules. And one of those rules was to do all the good you can, all the time you can, in every place you can, in every way you can. And that's what Methodist Hospital does.
You mentioned Methodist remaining downtown. And other hospital systems have made different choices in this community and other communities. During your time and involvement with Methodist, have there been discussions about the relationship between Methodist and the downtown area, and whether or not they should consider relocating the hospital?
There are almost daily conversations about the wisdom of staying downtown. If we're to continue delivering tertiary and quaternary care at the highest level, we must have an aggregation of the appropriate experts working all the time. The only way to do that is to maintain the downtown locations. So there's little or no risk that Methodist and University and Riley would leave downtown. But it is an ongoing dialogue because society has decided it doesn't respect and honor that core expertise. And so therefore society doesn't pay for it. And we have to go to the community and ask the community to generously contribute to our core mission in order to continue to provide the care that's provided here.
Interesting. When you use the phrase core expertise, obviously it carries the senses that you're physically at the core of an urban space as well as sort of this sort of central expertise you need to deliver those high levels of care. Has that consideration of whether or not downtown's the appropriate place changed from before the Clarion merger to now? Was it a different kind of discussion within Methodist before?
There had been discussions prior to the merger on January 1st, 97, about the appropriateness of Methodist staying downtown. The decision was basically sealed when the building on Center Boulevard was built. That would have been 15 years after our main competitor left downtown. So the market was clearly moving to the suburbs at that point in time. And the then CEO and board decided to stay downtown for the reasons that I just espoused. The transportation system in Indianapolis is pretty good. You can get to 21st and Capitol on I-65 very quickly. In fact, ironically, quicker now than you can to many of the suburban places because of the grid pattern of the roads. This is nothing new, though. Methodist Hospital first sought to locate itself at 30th and Illinois, behind what is now the Children's Museum. And the people of the neighborhood opposed it. This lot at 16th and Capitol was a baseball field. Baseball at the time was considered an unattractive use of land, so baseball happened to be in neighborhoods that weren't attractive otherwise. That's how Methodist ended up where it is right now. We wanted to be in the suburbs in 1899 and couldn't do it, and we're located right downtown and have been ever since.
During the early 1990s, in the period before the discussions that led to the creation of Clarion began, what was your role with Methodist Hospital at that time?
What year was that again?
This would be looking at around 1990.
1990?
Mm-hmm.
I was on the board in 1990.
And how long had you been serving on the board?
Brand new.
At that time, from your perspective, what were the changes, how was the medical marketplace in central Indiana changing, and how was that affecting the prospects at Methodist Hospital?
The percent of patients who were Medicare, Medicaid, or charity care was increasing dramatically. So suddenly it became important that size mattered. The bigger you were, the lower your unit costs were. And Methodist in the early 90s started a quest to find potential partners with which to merge. At the same time, every other big hospital was doing the same thing and led to, in the mid-90s, a spate of academic medical centers merging with community hospitals. Most of those have failed or dissolved. And Methodist IU Riley is one of the few left standing. So the market began to move in the 90s, just like downtown Indianapolis. I don't know if you were here at the time, probably not, but downtown Indianapolis in 1990 was non-existent. It had disappeared in the previous 10 years until Circle Center Mall reopened and started a revitalization of it. So it was pretty bleak downtown. I think our decision to stay downtown and to merge with the university, which is also downtown, has led to a higher level of expertise and care for more acutely ill patients who would otherwise have to go elsewhere for that care.
When you were serving on the board and the prospect of the IU-Riley Methodist merger was brought to the table, What was your initial reaction, and what was the reaction generally from the board and the broader Methodist community in terms of the possibility of merging with the university?
The board reaction was one of skepticism that the faculty at the university would want to merge with anybody. The faculty have other missions, research and education. Methodist was a teaching hospital, a very large teaching hospital, but it didn't have the core mission of research, education, and clinical care. So there was skepticism that it could even work out. At the same time, the leadership of Methodist was speaking with other large hospital systems in the state. So basically the answer is skepticism. That was the initial reaction.
And how long did it take at the board level for, I guess one question, who was driving the process of changing that skeptical opinion?
Then CEO, the chairman of the board, who was chairman at the time the negotiations started, and then me, mm-hmm. who was chairman at the time that the merger occurred, and the chairman of the IU Board of Trustees, who was not on the Methodist board, but was someone who was well known to a number of people on the Methodist board. So those were the leaders that tried to drive it. The bishop of the Methodist Church established his own task force to evaluate the merger, and his own task force voted against it, and he overruled them in approving the merger. His task force was comprised of two active lay people in the Methodist Church, one a former businessman, one a state senator, and my own father, and they voted against it. And their reasons for voting against it was a sale without cash. That is, the church was selling a major asset, change of control, and getting nothing back for it in terms of cash. And it would prove to be a mistake to deal with the faculty. That the faculty are culturally different to the point that they were members of a different tribe, and that they would not willingly change how they did business. So that was the recommendation of the bishop's committee. The bishop, however, was on the board of Methodist Hospital at the time. Hmm. He thanked them for their advice and then voted for the merger.
That transformation, you said that you were one of, within the board as chairman, you were one of the people who had to work to change that skepticism. Who first brought the idea to you?
The CEO, Bill Loveday.
And when he first brought the proposal to you, do you recall your reaction at the time?
I thought, well, that's a nice idea. We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. But not much enthusiasm. Mm-hmm.
Just yet another possible merger.
Right. It was early 90s, remember, Hillary Clinton, 93. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew what was going to happen, but none of it was going to be good mm-hmm. in terms of reimbursement. So everything was up for grabs. That managed care was just ramping up. Reimbursement was actually going down mm-hmm. because of managed care. In fact, reimbursements and costs went down in the mid-90s.
At that time, if the merger hadn't happened, was there a clear growth plan for Methodist if it was going to continue along?
Yes, the growth plan for Methodist included a robust series of suburban surgery centers, which did open up. We opened up four of them in the early 90s. The creation of a primary care group called Methodist Medical Group, which had 130 physicians in it at the time of the merger, and the creation of a holding company called Methodist Health Group, Inc., to acquire other hospitals. And the rapid expansion of M-Plan, our own insurance, HMO, managed care organization. So Methodist was always a big hospital in the United States and was much bigger than any other hospital in Indiana by a multiple, and in the top 15 or 20 nationwide. So it was growing along that path.
Once the board is confronted with this is a real possibility, and you mentioned that the president of the Board of Trustees of IU was an active early participant. What arguments or what facts were presented to the board that made possible that transformation and the lead and the vote to merge with the IU hospitals?
Well, there was the creation of a number of working teams of physicians to evaluate and analyze every working part of all three downtown hospitals, Riley, University, and Methodist. So that assuaged many of the fears that the physicians couldn't work together, because in fact they didn't work together. Number two, there was a business analysis of the future of all three hospitals, and it wasn't good. Just because you're big doesn't mean you're going to be robust 20 years from now. So there was a general feeling after due consideration that getting bigger was better, and competing downtown within less than a mile of each other wasn't good. And then thirdly, we'd be better able to negotiate contracts with payers, third-party administrators, insurance companies, HMOs, as a larger unit than we would be on our own. So the reasons were clinical. The docs got together and said, we can do it. And business. We can drive down our unit costs and we can negotiate better contracts. Now, this is hardly rocket science. Banks, department stores, and other businesses have been doing it for 100 years. Healthcare, though, is highly balkanized. Every county's got its own hospital. Big counties like Marion have got four or five. The fact is, the patients really don't care. The patients get in their car and drive the 10 minutes to go to another hospital if their doc sends them there, right? And the only reason you would go to one hospital over another is because of your primary care specialist referral. The buildings are basically the same. The difference in Methodist and now in Clarion is the level of expertise. And there's competition for that expertise, and we thought it would be better to recruit. We'd be more successful in replenishing our scarcest resource, and that is the physician expertise, if we were bigger and had more to offer. Mm-hmm. So that was really the tip point.
As you say, one of the things for patients, from the patient's perspective, is that, you know, a building is a building, and it really depends on their primary care provider and where the referral comes from. How does, given that so much of the core professional values of these hospitals lie in, you know, tertiary care and cutting edge medicine, in planning for the merger, how did those values of primary care access, which is obviously an important feeder system, and allocation of resources between primary care and specialty care, were those problematic dynamics in terms of breadth of coverage of primary care versus investment in specialty care resources?
Well, in the early 90s, there was a war between the major hospital systems to acquire primary care groups. Shortly thereafter, there was a war between the specialty groups, not between the specialty groups and their hospitals, to organize themselves. So that led to the formation of the care group, which is cardiologists and primary care doctors, after American Health Network was formed by Anthem in 94-95. CoreVAS, Indianapolis Neurosurgical Group, several radiology groups that were international, in other words, they served multiple hospitals. Clarion and the predecessor hospitals had all those groups anyway, so the question was how to keep them and how to feed them, and we feed them with the primary care groups, which was a strategy that existed well before the formation of Clarion. The resources, the competition for resources is primary care is a fairly low utilizer of resources. Mm-hmm. There are offices in Shelby County and elsewhere. They're not high utilizers of resources. The people that are the high utilizers of resources are the specialists and the subspecialists who require tight management and evidence-based medicine in order to maximize the efficacy of their care as well as the reasonableness of its cost. So we've never had a competition between primary care and specialty care for resources. Both have asked for more, both have deserved more, but we've never done one at the expense of the other. And frankly, after the merger, it was easier to assist both than it was to favor one over the other. And still have, between IUMG and MMG, the biggest primary group in the state, by far, feeding the specialists downtown. And Riley and University themselves are referral hospitals, and Methodist surgeon who knows what he's doing. Everybody outside of Annapolis comes to downtown Annapolis for brain surgery every day. Every day somebody comes here for trauma repair every day. Every day somebody comes here for a transplant, second largest transplant center in the country. So by any objective measure, the merger in bringing more tertiary and quaternary specialists together in a bigger facility has been successful. The primary care physicians are much lower paid, have an inferiority complex as a result of that, and get treated sometimes as hourly employees. We try not to do that. I'm sure we succumb to that temptation every once in a while. And that's one of the reasons the Clarion built the suburban hospitals. There'd be a level down of care, and our own primary care people wouldn't be torn between referring someone to a suburban competitor as opposed to downtown. And the reason those places exist is so they can make a profit and they can transfer to downtown, and we can maintain our education and research mission and still stay downtown.
Two questions about, again, the sort of the period of the merger, and there are sort of ethics and value questions. One is the general one. I mean, you obviously had Methodist Hospital, which is a faith-based organization, and you had the IU Hospital, the IU Medical Center, the IU Hospital, and Riley Hospital, that were entities that had grown up in a public medical school that had been founded in, you know, as a progressive era, right around Flexner kind of medical school. As the leadership of the two groups worked together, and you're working through all the business details, but there was also these details of mission and values. How did those conversations progress? I mean, what did it take? Were there real stumbling blocks in terms of getting the level of trust in terms of shared mission between the leadership?
Stumbling block may be too strong a word, but impediment would be. The literal translation of impediment is to stub your toe. Mm-hmm. So there are plenty of opportunities to stub your toe on somebody else's mental model. Your mental model as an academic professor of medicine would be maybe first teaching, second research, third clinical care. A private physician's mental model might be clinical care first, teaching second, and research third. So right away, you had an impediment because you were tripping over each other's order of priorities. So we resolved that at the highest levels by creating in the definitive agreement, and we negotiated long and hard on this, an education research committee of the board, chaired by the dean of the medical school, who's on the board, and staffed by a physician from the academic. So all research and all education questions had to go to that committee before they made their way to the board. On the church side, on the values side, we established a values and ethics committee, chaired by an active United Methodist, Sarah Evans Barker, no relation. And it duty was to preserve the values of the church, all of which I agreed with anyway, but to preserve the values of the church. And we hired an ethics, we hired a senior vice president for pastoral care and ethics to staff that committee, who reports to that committee and to the CEO. Mm-hmm. CEO can't fire this person. So we institutionalized the ethics operations at the highest level of the organization, and the education research was done the same way. So at the end of the day, we were able to incorporate it into the organizational documents, both the church's needs and the university needs. That's not to say that there isn't stress down below mm-hmm. the board level to see to it that those are carried out. We just awarded our $10 millionth dollar in grants from the Ethics and Values Committee. As a result of the Clarion merger, we set aside a pot of money to give grants to young researchers, young principal investigators, and it's been a stellar success. You know, a place like this with 3,000 staff, medical staff, there are lots of people with ideas who've yet to get their first NIH grant, but they're going to get one. Mm-hmm. And on the way it works is the Education Research Committee reviews hundreds of grant applications and makes a recommendation to the Ethics and Values Committee, which makes a recommendation to the board. So it's become a collaboration. The board itself is a collaboration between these two silos of educational research and clinical care. So that's how we got over it.
The you talked about the vision of it as a collaboration between education research and ethics and values. This is sort of a more contemporary question, but you talked about it in the light of how things have changed. Does it still feel like a collaboration between a Methodist group and a IU Medical Center group, or is the, you know, how has it gone in terms of those sensibilities, those institutional sensibilities? Is it evolving to a point where there is an organic sort of Clarion culture?
It's gone from a collaboration at the beginning to partnership in the middle to common enterprise today. That it's been an evolution. Collaboration was, you stay where you are, I'll stay where I am, and we'll collaborate. You know, we'll work together when we need to. Partnership is, well, okay, you're liable for my mistakes, I'm liable for yours, we'll jointly decide where the assets go, but we're going to maintain our separate identities, we're just partners. Now, joint enterprise is a recognition that everything we do relates to everything that happens, and we need to do it together, that is the medical school and Clarion. So there's become a Clarion way now, and a medical school way, where we actually meet as a common group. That just started in the last 18 months, where the dean and the CEO and our direct reports actually meet together to discuss policy and tactics. And that took 10 years to get to that point. Our ultimate goal with common enterprise is to merge all of the physicians into one employer group. And we're working on that right now. That'll be what happens in the next year to 3 years. So let's say that happens 3 years outside 2011, then it would have been 10 years. And that's my guess. It takes 10 years to go through an evolution this dramatic, that is from completely separate to collaboration, to partnership, to common enterprise, to single enterprise. Mm-hmm. It's just the way culture operates. There's no big bang along the way. And the common thread throughout all of that is trust. Mm-hmm. And trust is a hard thing to achieve, very easy thing to lose. And the line oscillates the whole way during this progression to single entity. The medical school itself is very pluralistic. Mm-hmm. Very pluralistic. It's a bunch of corporations, right? Bunch of corporations. That's just like the private practices. There is no difference. Except the medical school faculty practice groups have a franchise awarded them by what we call the medical school, which doesn't exist, by the way, as a legal entity. Mm-hmm. It's just a division within Indiana University, And the medical school doesn't provide the care. The faculty practice groups provide the care. That's just like the private groups. So I keep saying to them, guys, you're more alike than you are different. Mm-hmm. Much more alike. And that is beginning, the dean and I are saying that to folks, and that's beginning to resonate with them. Now we've got folks coming to us and saying, how quickly can we do this? Whereas in the recent past, they'd say, oh, please don't do this. So there's a growing realization that modern medicine is all about collaborative. The patient could care less how many corporations are involved and shouldn't care. And in fact, the multiplicity of corporate vehicles to deliver care is what causes error, lack of proper management. When a doctor in Shelby County refers to a doctor in Annapolis, there's no common EMR. I personally think that's immoral. If my car breaks down in Shelby County, there is a record of my car that's available. So if I go to a Toyota dealer in Shelbyville, my Toyota dealer here will be able to transmit all the data to me. In fact, it just happened to me. Same thing is true of my ATM card. I was in Brussels yesterday. I needed to get money for a cab. So in downtown Brussels, I put my ATM card in the machine, poke in my PIN number, and got 100 euros. I can't do that here with my health care. The future is not all this pluralism. The future is common enterprise, common employer. And for what reason? For our reason, for the patients. Who can argue with that? As far as I know, only a robust academic medical center like Clarion could argue clearly for that result. Most other healthcare systems benefit from being separate. We think we benefit from being one because it's clear to us what the goal is to improve the care for the patient. Awesome.